You're listening to First Wall Rebate.
Welcome to another episode of First Wall Rebate. I am Sean Ryder, and with me as always is Shane Hinton. How you doing, Shane?
Hello, hello.
And tonight we are Trevor-less, as they say. but we are not without a suitable replacement for our own Trevor Dodge. We're joined tonight by Julian DeBell, author of our book club book, My Tiny Life. Julian, thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. We're thrilled to have Julian with us tonight. Really a true legend when it comes to writing about games and game worlds and online worlds and the social dynamics of what we call the cyber culture. Julian has done so much work. It's really hard to kind of list it concisely in terms of an introduction. But a lot of it starts with My Tiny Life, which is kind of a seminal volume, I would say, in the realm of game studies and game criticism, and actually, I think, has affected
quite... Are you allowed to say seminal volume?
I think so. I mean, aside from the fact that I have my Canon card in the back pocket, so I can pretty much just put whatever I want to in there, and truly, I think that My Tiny Life is one of the most important books that people have been exposed to. And I think people have been exposed to it regularly, and you see sort of tendrils of it throughout a lot of work. But nonetheless, he's kept on producing and writing. I'm sorry to speak about you in the third person while you're on the show and everything. But I want to mention Play Money, which, if people haven't read, is a fascinating study about the economics of online game worlds. As well as the numerous articles that you've done for places like the New York Times and Wired Magazine, including your latest piece on Project Chanology, which I thought was a really excellent, both accessible and well-knowledgeable write-up about Anonymous and their raid on the Church of Scientology. So having said all of that, thank you once again, Julian, for coming on the show.
Wow, thank you.
I think that might qualify as our biggest introduction, too. I was trying to go for some kind of, you know, suitably monumental intro there.
Oh, it's, you know, if you'd given me a foot massage, I couldn't have been happier.
Well, you know, I just want to kind of open the discussion to, you know, when you started writing about this stuff was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but really back in 1993 that... the Rape in Cyberspace essay first came out, right?
Yeah, that's right. December of 93.
And so what even brought you to approaching a world like Lambda Mu in this way?
Well, you mean as an object of sort of cultural examination? I mean, what do you mean by in this way?
Well, absolutely fair. I think on the back of my copy of the book, it lists it as a memoir/technology book, which sounds a lot like, you know, army intelligence or something like that. It's a total oxymoron. And I think of two completely different things when I think about those genres typically separately. However, I think My Tiny Life is absolutely both a really wonderful technological history and study in a lot of ways of different technological social paradigms that were coming up. But I think also that, you know, you do bring this memoir, very personalized aspect to it. Parts of the book, I think, read almost, like a novel. So, and that was something that, and, you know, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think even today we don't really see a lot with discussions of online worlds or game spaces or things like that. It usually tends to be focused on, things like technology or marketing or something along those lines. So,
well, so at the time, to give a little bit of a personal background, I had started out as a pop music writer. That's what I was generally focusing on. But I had a very kind of a pointed agenda. You know, I thought that by writing about pop culture, by writing about a form of culture that was, you know, looked down on as lower on the cultural totem pole than, say, you know, the canonic books I had just spent 4 years reading as an English major, I thought I was fighting a kind of, you know, important cultural fight for cultural democracy, you know, that you know, to show that culture was an ampler and you know, more inclusive space than some of the institutions that try to manage it end up making it. So, and you know, in fact, I think that's a valuable part of what a lot of the great pop music and pop cultural writers have been doing. But by the time I got into the business of writing rock criticism, I realized that, you know, there have been a lot of people at this for a lot longer than I had. And, you know, when it came right down to it, I was really, you know, I was partly just a, you know, you're partly just an extension of the music industry as a music critic in some ways, or more so than I had expected to be. So I was somewhat dissatisfied with that line of work, but still very interested in these questions of democratic participatory culture. And, you know, just as kind of an accidental part of my work, I needed to upload my articles, you know, from home, or it was now possible with computers and modems. So I said, hey, yeah, that's a lot easier than, you know, taking the subway into Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I got a modem, and I stumbled down the rabbit hole into this world of, you know, BBS. This was before the internet. You know, you could dial up a bulletin board system and discover this whole world of argumentation and play and creativity that was really, you know, unbelievably democratic, anarchic almost. It was, everybody now had a printing press, right? I mean, that was the obvious realization right then. Mm-hmm. So I started pursuing this. I started writing about computer hackers and other aspects of online culture. But when I stumbled one day onto Lambda Moo, which was and is, it's still out there, a text-based online virtual world, I saw an almost like a perfect venue for working out how a lot of the issues being brought up by this technology for, you know, the possibilities of new forms of community, new forms of sociality, new forms of governance were playing out. You know, it was kind of, Lambda Moo was great because it was this fictional world, right? You logged in and you got this, you know, wall of text saying you are standing in the middle of a living room. There's a, you know, cozy little fireplace burning over here. There are, you know, this person and that person and that person hanging out talking, and you would, you know, and then you could wander around the grounds and discover little games hidden in the corner, or, you know, meet new people in other parts of the house, or after a while start adding on to the house and extending the grounds. Mm-hmm. So it was this, very vividly presented kind of metaphor for the way in which, you know, the online spaces really were a new kind of social space. Instead of just, just a new kind of telephone or a new kind of printing press or a new kind of, you know, whatever the other media technologies you wanted to compare it to, it really was a social space. So, and I was not the first person to write about this. I think by the time Rape in Cyberspace came out, or at least shortly thereafter, Howard Rheingold's book, Virtual Community, had come out. And that was a very sort of, comprehensive survey of some of the spaces that were emerging, like The Well and Usenet and things like that, and the ways in which, all these questions of community and sociality were coming up already. But I've always thought, coming from, I was starting out at the Village Voice at the time, which is a bastion of the new journalist tradition, which is, very much about putting the I, the not necessarily the ego of the writer, but the perspective and the circumstances of the writer right at the heart of the story, as a way of, just kind of telling the story more honestly, or at least more more true to the personal experience of it. Mm-hmm. It's almost an ethnographic approach in a way. I mean, it's very like the participant observer approach to things. And so, that was just obviously the way to go at it, was, not just to talk to the people involved, but to get involved myself. Partly because, it is, again, such a participatory medium. Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, not just in some ways, but I mean, you sort of directly throughout the book kind of tap into that feeling that a lot of people have when they're engaging with online worlds or game worlds, which is this almost sort of shame to be duplicating your social life, or to be seen as sort of like maybe fulfilling some kind of weakness in your real life social realm. And that throughout the book, we kind of see that causes various repercussions actually in the real world for you. Can you talk just a little bit about, and maybe not even My Tiny Life in general? I mean, I can't imagine that writing about Scientology and Anonymous is completely without repercussion. How do you balance sort of your willingness to put kind of everything out there and let people see what your experiences are in these realms where a lot of people just don't feel comfortable with that at all?
Well, I mean, that's part and parcel of a grand tradition in writing about and experiencing online culture. Is that we're becoming much more open with what was formerly a very private experience, or private experiences, and in My Tiny Life, I ended up writing about, how this was my involvement in Lambda Mu, particularly, in the tiny sex aspect of it, which was the, graphical cybering, as the kids call it nowadays. So we called it tiny sex. How that kind of, had repercussions in terms of my real life relationship. And, and it seems obvious now in a lot of ways, but a lot of the work I was doing then was to show that, in fact, it wasn't just this you know, pathetic shadow of real life, what was going on online. It was, you know, it was part of real life, a very different part with very peculiar characteristics, and very tricky, you know, media effects, but definitely a real part of life.
We actually, that's we received a question from networker Mez that kind of ties into to some of the things that you're talking about there, and she's curious about how you regard notions of the private and how that varies in terms of contemporized notions of the virtual, in terms of Mr. Bungle, and how that incident could translate into today's upcoming augmented reality embodied robotic avatars.
Okay, well, we covered a lot of ground in that question. Let me just let's get to robotic avatars maybe later, but you know, the issue of privacy is a very live one right now, especially with social networks exploding, and you know, the weirdness of Facebook, you know, the wonderful Facebook update that was making the rounds a few weeks ago of the guy who hooked up with a girl that he'd been, you know, really interested in, and posted it on, you know, on his Facebook page, had a really good night last night, and first commenter was his mom, who, you know, liked the comment. And then suddenly was like, oh goodness, you know, how do I delete a like? And then he's like, Mom, you know, what the fuck? And you know, that kind of crossing of social worlds, and people negotiating the ways that our social spheres, the clarity of our social spheres, is suddenly not that clear anymore, and has been really you know, blurred by things like social networks, and you know, and already by blogs, and the habit of people have of being public about their private lives in ways that can come back to bite them in the ass later on. So that's a big deal, and it's related to another issue that's really at the heart of a lot of what I've been writing, which is you know, the idea of identity, you know, having an online identity, and how tightly or loosely connected is it to our offline or so-called real-life identity. And that has all kinds of repercussions, not just in terms of what, you know, our sense of privacy is, what our evolving expectations of privacy are, but, you know, in just how discourse and interaction unfolds, right? So the central story, or the sort of inaugural story of my tiny life is the rape in cyberspace story, right? Mr. Bungle, comes in, and he's this sort of evil clown character, who enacts these, you know, kind of rape-like emotes, you know, kind of these virtual acts of sexual violation on some of the people hanging out in that cozy living room of Lambda Mu. And, you know, the question is, what made this guy feel, you know, emboldened to do something like this? Is he a person who in real life would do something like this? Or is it the fact that, you know, there is this shell of anonymity, or in some cases pseudonymity, depending on, you know, how things unfold, that, you know, allows him not to feel the normal sense of social restraint. Now, in the case of Mr. Bungle, it turned out to be, yeah, in fact, maybe this was not one person. The story I was eventually told was that, you know, this was an account sort of held in common by a whole dorm floor of guys at NYU who, you know, were randomly getting on to, you know, maybe make trouble or just goof around. And one of them or some of them ended up, you know, committing this virtual transgression. Now, at the time, that was this sort of weird, wow, you know, what kind of sociopathy is this? You know, what, and how is it framed by issues of identity and the fluidity of identity online? Nowadays, that whole phenomenon and the whole discussion about it has gotten much more sophisticated. Even though we have lots of progress to make in terms of, you know, really speaking and thinking sensibly about it. But, you know, we now have places like Facebook where there is a strong, you know, despite all the weirdnesses about privacy and you know, our social world sort of sloshing around in there, there is a strong ethic and even regulatory framework within Facebook of using your real name, right? Mm-hmm. So as to keep that connection strong. At the same time, this phenomenon of, you know, what would now be called griefing, that you know, the Mr. Bungle, the evil clown character, was perpetrating, you know, where people come in and mess with people's online game world, you know, and try to ruin the game for them because it gives them a kind of perverse pleasure to do so, is now recognized as not just this, you know, lone sociopathy that, you know, sociopathology, that how do we treat these sick individuals? It's actually sort of a really quite bold, elaborate and sophisticated online subculture of griefers and trolls. Mm-hmm. The griefer being sort of the online game world subset of the larger set of trolls, which is, you know, people who delight in going into online communities, say, you know, a cat lover's mailing list, you know, and posting a recipe for kitten stew, you know, and then watching as you know, the members of the community rise to the bait and get furious and, you know, and start, you know, eventually making asses of themselves. These people, you know, they have their own sort of code of ethics now. They have their own communities. They collaborate on these trolling and griefing expeditions. And they have their own very elaborate culture, the epicenter of which, of course, is 4chan, interestingly, completely anonymous messaging board, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it is a place where it has the exact opposite kind of situation of Facebook, where you kind of could go on and create a pseudonym on Facebook, but there's lots of pressure to use your real name. On 4chan, you can adopt a pseudonym. You could even use your real name, but everyone posts under the handle of anonymous. That's sort of the way it works, and that's why it works, and that's why people are so incredibly creative about their trolling. You know, at this point, I've come sort of 180 degrees since writing that rape in cyberspace story, where I was mainly interested in, you know, how Mr. Bungle's victims responded and how the community responded to his transgression. As far as what his motivations were and what he thought he was doing, that was kind of just black boxed his mind. Mm-hmm. And said, well, he's just, you know, a kind of a problem that online communities have to deal with. Now I'm kind of more interested in, you know, what's going on in the mind, you know, of Mr. Bungle and in the culture now of Mr. Bungle, because I think, you know, whereas the burden on me at the time was to say, you know, to convey to audiences, to readers, that no, these online worlds really are worth taking seriously, and people can be hurt, and do have emotional investments in them that matter. I think, you know, everybody sort of understands that now, and what's harder to convey now is sort of how the weirdness, the peculiarities of the mediating effects of online life make it hard to always say exactly where your emotional investments should be and how far they should go. And I think, like, the trolls and griefers, you know, play an almost, you know, they'd hate for me to hear me say it, but almost a useful role in the larger culture of online life, in the sense that they kind of are there to, you know, keep people alive to the possibility that maybe they're taking this all too seriously. You know, because once you find yourself crying over a computer game, you know, you've got to kind of think about your priorities, and that's what the trolls and griefers are there to, you know, bring people to do.
I like that. I really like that take on it, and it makes me, it leads me to another question that I had about your writing about Lambda Mu, which is that we kind of take things like Lambda Mu and then Second Life, which I also want to mention at some time during this, because that seems to me so directly the evolution of what Lambda Mu was sort of trying to offer. We lump those in with games often, but they aren't really games. Games can happen within them, but there's something else. And I think a lot of people who write and talk about this kind of have this sort of sublingual understanding of it's not a game like those games, but at the same time, in some way, it fits in with those games. And I wonder, also in light of what you were saying about griefers and the fact that, you know, in some ways, to me, 4chan does, I mean, there are definitely game aspects to 4chan, the 4chan experience, right? And there's strict rule sets and end goals and all those wonderful game design things that you're supposed to look for. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of how you see all of these different sorts of environments as overlapping and intersecting.
Well, it's a great point to bring up, because, you know, by the time I finally published My Tiny Life, which was about 5 years after the rape in cyberspace story, you know, I was already starting to realize, you know, I was already sort of doing the revisions in my head of what I was missing, and also what the evolution of these spaces was showing me I had missed. And one of the first ones was, you know, I really should have gotten more into the gaming side of the virtual world phenomenon. Because by then, by about 1998 and 1999, It was the gaming worlds that were producing the phenomenon which became the subject of my next book, The Virtual Economies, and that became the subject of Play Money, which was the chronicle of the my year trying to make a living selling virtual tchotchkes from Ultima Online. Which was hilarious and enlightening. But, you know, also really showed me that I had to take the gaming side of things very seriously, because it was not the worlds like, you know, the Palace or Lambda Mu that, you know, these kind of completely open spaces that were producing the virtual economies. It was these hardcore gaming worlds like Ultima Online and EverQuest, where you had a very definite mapped out progression and a really, you know, strongly enforced artificial scarcity, which is the essence of games, you know. One person's going to win, right? I mean, that's sort of the basic game meta role. And that is a, you know, a condition of artificial scarcity. And it's that that produces these fabulous, fascinating virtual economies with their amazing spillovers into the real economy, you know, which is the first, you know, my being able to make anything close to a living, you know, selling swords and castles from some online. But more staggeringly, the fact that, you know, there are now 400,000 people employed in China, you know, at 25 cents an hour to play World of Warcraft, you know, to literally go in there and harvest gold in these gold farms in China to sell to, you know, other players, for their employers to sell. So that turned out to be, you know, the biggest revision I had to make in my thinking about virtual worlds, was that games were really central to thinking about it. And in a way, that means that a space like Second Life is somewhat less interesting to me, and even Lambda Moose is less interesting to me in that light. But what it also tells me is that, you know, the people that are hell-bent on saying that these are not games, that Second Life is not a game, don't have it exactly right either. Second Life does not have, you know, the built-in leveling and progression and prizes and, you know, sort of constrained play that World of Warcraft and Lineage and things like this have. But as you point out, with 4chan, there are ways for things to be game-like without being, you know, strictly games. And Second Life doesn't have, you know, it doesn't even have the sort of the floating rules and mini games that 4chan has specifically. But, you know, anything that you can do of a practical, pragmatic, or even, you know, business-oriented nature in Second Life. And there's lots of, you know, IBM is experimenting with having meetings there, and various, you know, companies have experimented with doing, you know, virtual commerce in Second Life. But it's never the case that that's more practical or efficient. I think what really draws people to Second Life is the way in which it's kind of a playful imitation of real life. The aspect of, you know, it being a toy world. So you don't necessarily have to say that something is a game to acknowledge that there's something playful involved, or ludic, you know, to use a more highfalutin word, but that nicely, you know, generalizes the question, so that we don't get hung up on whether it's a game or not. Second Life doesn't have to be a game for it to have at its core some really ludic elements. And, you know, I have a whole rap about how that's, you know, that I've begun to develop in Play Money. I'm still working on, about how that's really becoming a really central part of the way we live now, you know, that play is becoming a way for, you know, capitalism to kind of extract more value out of us than simply by, you know, locking us into wage relations. But that maybe for another podcast. I don't know.
You know, when we talk about these digital societies, these virtual societies like 4chan and Lambda Moo, et cetera, it brings up an interesting point, and Lee Alexander wrote in to ask how you see the role that memes play in digital society and how their creation proliferation differs from how they're produced in the real world. And she wants to make sure that we pass along the information that you are apparently her favorite person in the universe, which I would take to be a pretty high compliment, really.
Wow. Yes, yeah. That is coming from Lee. obviously, memes, and by memes, you know, there are a lot of, you know, the strict original definition of what a meme is, you know, was Richard Dawkins trying to say that kind of ideas and mental habits have a way of propagating just like, you know, genetic material does. You know, they'll sort of, you know, using our brains as hosts, they're sort of these parasites on our minds, with, you know, and because, you know, if you're a hardcore materialist like Dawkins, you know, you believe, as most of us do, that, you know, every idea has a physical manifestation in our brain. So it's literally these kind of weird, you know, physical formations in the world, you know, jumping from brain to brain. Mm-hmm. And cause, you know, and he's saying, well, there are certain memes that are more, you know, have an evolutionary advantage, such as, you know, the belief in God or whatever, that somehow that spreads better because the mind really likes that, you know, and wants to, you know, spread it around, and the more people around you share that in that meme, you know, the happier you are. So it's a meme that spreads itself very virulently. But of course, in internet culture, we're talking about something much more specific, which is sort of these very small, you know, self-contained jokes that you know, whatever, like the Rickroll or lolcats, mm-hmm. that you know, spread virally is the sense. Although, you know, Henry Jenkins, who's a great media scholar, kind of pushes back against that idea of memes because it totally, you know, it evacuates any notion of agency from the culture that sustains memes. You know, it's the idea taken to its extreme, and that's sort of Richard Dawkins' version, is exactly that, you know, memes, you know, spread themselves. It's not that the people, you know, mm-hmm. who spread them have some stake in spreading them. Whereas, in fact, Henry says, Jenkins says, you know, the opposite, that, you know, people use memes to kind of make meaning out of their life, you know, to sort of both to cement social bonds with the people they share the meme with, and to sort of, you know, think through on a very, you know, small light level, you know, their feelings about, well, Rick Astley, for instance. But what I've seen, what interests me particularly about 4chan, is the way in which it is, because of this anonymity thing, right? This radical anonymity, which means not only is your identity disconnected from your real life identity, your offline identity, it's completely submerged into the collective identity of 4chan itself, even in the online space. Nobody ever really, you know, stands out as the most interesting anonymous. You know, you can't really tell who's the most, who's the funniest anonymous. Nobody knows. But so the memes then become this incredibly important structural element in constituting that culture, because you can't point to individuals and who you know within it. can point to the memes. We all know that meme. Mm-hmm. We all share in that meme. And so you have something inevitably like Encyclopedia Dramatica, which is sort of this add-on peripheral to 4chan, which is this amazing, you know, Wikipedia of the 4chan universe, which has all the memes in it and which is, you know, at my number one guilty pleasure, hands down. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. hilarious. Mm-hmm. But, you know, besides amusing people to death, it's also this repository. You know, it is the standing structure of, you know, of 4chan culture. And so I think what's, you know, interesting about online memes is the way not only that they circulate much more rapidly than offline memes may have, but the way that they're constitutive of people's, you know, online social life. I'm fumbling here because I'm trying to live up to, you know, Lily's expectations. I'm not sure I've quite hit the mark, but
I think you.
I'm hot on the trail of, you know, what memes are really about. Rest assured.
Well, you know, to create possibly the most awkward bridge in topics. So along the lines of distributing stuff in general, whether they be small ideas or large ideas, My Tiny Life, a couple years ago, you regained control of your manuscript from My Tiny Life. And I'm not sure how much our listeners will have done research, but the abbreviated story is sort of that there was kind of this roller coaster of you struggling to get rights from Henry Holt, the original publisher who had let publication lapse in North America. And then the result is that now we can get My Tiny Life for free, which I'm sure at least some of our listeners did, or we can buy copies directly from you, which is quite the 21st century take on the 20th century bit of techno criticism. So I'm wondering, kind of after all of that, how has that been for you? Would you go to all of that hassle again? And has that changed at all, sort of how you think the book is discussed or proliferated around?
I haven't seen it changing the conversation about it too much, although, you know, it's one of those things where once the thing is kind of out there floating around, you don't necessarily know, you know, what it's doing. I mean, the fact that, you know, you guys are having this discussion about the book may be, you know, a related factor, but I don't know. But I would definitely, you know, try to do it with any book that I publish from now on. The problem is, you know, it's hard to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't able to get the UK rights to My Tiny Life, which means that I'm not able to put a worldwide Creative Commons license on it, which means I'm not actually legally able to sort of, distribute it as freely as I'd like, but, you know, I'm just going ahead and doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of the way it goes anymore.
Do you see this? I mean, this is something that you're going to be into. I mean, is this something that sort of among the publishing community and the writer community that you interact with, is this something that a lot more people are considering?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's you know, you must know that right now the publishing world is finally being gobsmacked by the internet in the ways that, you know, the recording industry was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And are just, you know, scrambling like decapitated chickens to figure out how to regroup in the face of, you know, what you know, what the internet is doing first to, you know, the canary in the coal mine, the newspapers. And what the Kindle and related things will be doing to the book form. So everybody's, you know, it's hard to find at least, you know, any authors who are really think it's possible to circle the wagons and, you know, and stay the course and keep doing book publishing and article publishing the way that it's been done forever. Mm-hmm. You know, so everybody's looking for a way to experiment. That was one. I mean, the experiment I did with Play Money was a lot more fun, though probably mm-hmm. not as long lasting. One thing I released it in Second Life as a virtual book that you can actually sit there and read kind of over your virtual. Over your avatar's shoulder, mm-hmm. Which is a ridiculous way to read it, and yet it's sold, you know, maybe 100 copies or so. And I can only imagine again that why do you do that in Second Life? Well, because it's funny, it's playful, it's mm-hmm. there's a kind of toy aspect to it. But then I decided to take that virtuality to the next level, and I was invited. To go to an arts festival in Belgium, and they were like, well, can you do any art? And I was like, I don't, you know, I'm not an artist. So I said, well, what the hell? I tell you what, I will do a handcrafted book. I will handcraft a copy of Play Money. You know, and I did. I printed out the manuscript and sewed the binding and glued it all together. But then I decided, well, let's take this to the next. I've taken this book, you know, into virtual reality and back out, you know, into this, you know, completely pre-virtual handcrafted form. Mm-hmm. What's the next turn of the screw I can do? So I ended up, I thought about it and decided, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to wrap it in a EULA, an end user license agreement, that modeled on the license agreements for places like Second Life and for software that basically, you know, said that by buying this book, you don't actually own the book. You just, you're buying a token that you can exchange for a virtual copy of the book, you know, by sending it to me, by postal mail. If you send it, then, you know, so this is not actually a book and you're not actually licensed to read it. It's merely like I turned it into basically a financial instrument, you know, in mm-hmm. other words, that was sort of the final twist on it. I don't know, I sold about 3 copies and, I'm not sure that's the long-term model for these things either. But you know, you gotta play with the form at this point, or you know, because definitely doing it the old-fashioned way does not have a future to it.
I think maybe you and Ian Bogost could create the most absurd book and Atari VCS cartridge distribution company in the country.
As we talk about these different evolutions of media and the ways in which things are presented and delivered, et cetera, that's going to, I think, segue nicely into our final listener, friend of the show, previous guest comment from Ken Wark, who asked, in what ways were moves a precedent for today's media, and in what way not?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as I've said, there were a lot of things coming up at a very, you know, like at a pretty high level of abstraction. There is almost no social online phenomenon that I come across nowadays that one couldn't get at least an inkling of from hanging out in Lambda Mu. So, you know, issues of shared production, you know, how do you, as a loose-knit group of people who don't really know each other, collectively create this online virtual object, you know, which now we have see analogs of in all kinds of things like Wikipedia and open source software. How do you the big issue that you know is a perennially educational insight for me was seeing how the administrators of Lambda Mu, you know, who really bought into this idea of democratic online culture, were eager to withdraw from the management of the social life of Lambda Mu, right? And so this was really what A Rape in Cyberspace was about, was this moment where the wizards, as they called themselves, really the administrators of Lambda Mu, came to the users and the players of Lambda Mu and said, look, we will maintain the server for you, but you've got to stop coming to us with your, you know, interpersonal conflicts and your social issues, because A, we're tired of it, and B, we don't think it's a very promising model for, you know, for online governance. And so they just sort of left it up to them. And so this interesting stuff started to emerge of people sort of trying to create a petition system and, you know, a little virtual court system. And it was all very interesting. But eventually what you saw was the fact that the admins were, you know, ultimately in control of the server gave them a level of control that they could not get, you know, they could not get rid of even if they wanted to, and they did want to. Mm-hmm. You know, they could never step all the way back. And in fact, they ended up having to come back and be more involved in the social life, because that's just the ultimate paradox. Whoever owns the server really is ultimately in charge. And so, you know, how is this an issue now? Well, you know, Google has really shifted the center of gravity of the internet, right? When the internet was young, it was truly distributed. You know, it was on as many computers as there were servers, and the servers were distributed among a lot of institutions and shareholders and individuals. Google isn't the internet, but it's practically, you know, it's almost as important as DNS now. You know, as sort of the basic, you know, it's where you go to find stuff on the internet. So it's basically the choke point, and, you know, it runs on servers owned by Google Incorporated, and that's behind a huge set of questions people are asking about Google's role in online life now. You know, where things have not gone that, you know, maybe I thought, and certainly a lot of people thought they would go, was in the direction of hardcore, you know, virtual reality. You know, Snow Crash had come out just around then. And you know, that inspired a generation of people who are still trying to realize this vision of, you know, of 3D virtual reality cyberspace, you know, robotic avatars perhaps someday, you know, emerging out of the augmented version of it. But, you know, a literal cyberspatial immersive 3D reality as the universal interface for the online world was something a lot of people believed in, and a few people still do believe in, but I certainly don't, and I don't think it's really has happened and is going to happen. And partly, again, why? Because, you know, people missed how much, you know, of a playful ideal that was. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, if you use it as your, you know, your universal workspace and, you know, travel agent's office or whatever, you know, just all these absurd, you know, why do I want to, you know, there were even people would say, oh yeah, you want to shop for books in a place like Second Life because it recreates the browsing experience of real bookstores. Well, no, actually, you know, I kind of would rather browse through the Amazon interface, but you know, it might be fun sometime to go into a virtual bookstore. Mm-hmm. So I think the ways in which, you know, Lambda Mu was taken by some of the people in it to be like the future of interfaces, as, you know, Second Life sometimes is today, proved to be misleading.
I'd agree with you. I think I've always been fascinated by sort of how at some point in time the science world was trumped by the game world in the reality of virtual reality. And and that really, you know, now it's sort of like they've got this kind of we can't beat them, so we're going to join them attitude. And you see a lot of really interesting things happening. You know, I especially think of like John Lee and like his experiments with the Wii controllers and stuff like that. But yeah, that's absolutely fascinating stuff, Julian. We could obviously keep going. That's part of the reason why I really advocated for My Tiny Life to be a part of our book club, was just that it truly touches so many things that I think are completely relevant and completely just in our faces all the time today. And it's this real stark reminder that that we're just not the first ones to feel this way or have, you know, confront these issues. And definitely appreciate that. I think before the show we were talking, and sort of a nice extension that our listeners may well be interested in, and something that I'm definitely keen to check out, is that you were mentioning that you have work featured in the latest collection, The Best of Technology Writing. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
I do, and the piece that's in there is the piece I wrote for Wired last year about griefers. So if you want to like dig deeper into this phenomenon of game griefers and trolls, you could check it out. The Best Technology Writing of 2009, edited by Stephen Johnson, the eminent technology writer, including pieces by Dana Boyd, Clay Shirky, Farhad Manju, Nicholas Carr. It's good stuff. And the exciting related announcement I have to make is that I will be editing next year's collection of The Best Technology Writing, 2010, following in the footsteps of Stephen Johnson, before him Clive Thompson, and before him Stephen Levy. So it's an illustrious company. I'm really thrilled and honored to be following along. And we are open for nominations. Those of you listening who have an opinion about you know, any excellent pieces of writing about, whether about games or technology, digital technology generally, or even not digital technology, really, I'm open to anything, you know, about you know, new forms of energy technology or biotechnology. Really, it's wide open. And if you check my website, www.juliandebell.com, I will be putting up information shortly about how you can link into the nomination form and submit a nomination there. So I hope you'll come in and do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That's a First Wall Rebate exclusive, right? We get the announcement of the nomination form. I think that is an exclusive that is befitting of our show. Thank you so much for coming on to discuss your book with us, Julian DeBell. If people haven't caught on to it yet, it's called My Tiny Life. It's available through Lulu. We've got links all over First Wall Rebate right now to check it out. It's definitely one of the best reads that I know of. If you haven't yet read it, then hopefully this whet your appetite, and now you are kicking yourself for slack in the last couple months. And I think I would want to also remind people to check us out again on Twitter and on Facebook. We are at First Wall Rebate on Twitter and have a URL that's linked from firstwallrebate.com on Facebook, and try to do fun things there sometimes when Shane feels like it. I think that rounds out our plugs. Do you have anything, Shane?
I want to make sure and thank again Lee Alexander, Networker Mez, and Mackenzie Warwick, who took the time to write in with questions about this book that, as you said in the beginning, Sean, is a seminal work in kind of this discipline that we're all so interested in. And I want to remind people, you know, that you don't have to be like these three. You don't have to be a brilliantly minded, exquisitely articulate games writer, journalist, artist in order to participate in our games club. You know, we're happy to have our book club, rather. We're happy to have all of our listeners participate, and hopefully some of you who set this round out will jump in for the next one, and we'll be announcing that title shortly, I expect.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, Julian, and for myself, I'm Sean Ryder.
And I'm Shane Hinton.
This has been First Ball Reboot. I'm not so good at the intro outro, but...